Good morning from 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. And welcome to our election special candidates forum. As each Sunday this month, we speak to one candidate running for local or state office. Now here are your hosts, Bob McAdams and Jeff Leonard.
Good Sunday morning, Charlottesville. I'm Jeff Leonard, general manager of WPVC.
And I'm Bob McAdams, special events coordinator at WPVC.
Today we're co-hosting a WPVC election special, one of our interviews with candidates seeking to represent our area in state senate. WPVC does not endorse any candidate for public office. However, we provide this information to you, our listeners, to help you make the best choice.
And with us in the studio this morning is Democratic State Senate candidate Cree Deeds, who is seeking re-election as senator representing the 25th District. Cree, welcome to WPVC.
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
You found us okay?
I did, yes. Yeah,
excellent.
Cree, let's start by learning a little of your history. Where were you born, and what was your life like as you were growing up?
Well, I'm from Bath County, and I still live about 4 miles upstream from a house some of my ancestors built in the 1740s. But the problems of Bath County in the 50s are the same as they are today. There's not much work. My parents were living in Richmond when I was born. My parents separated and divorced when I was just a little boy, and I grew up in Bath County on my mother's father's farm in the eastern part of the county. That's pretty much. I grew up a kid. We lived in a trailer for a number of years on the farm after my mother remarried, but. That's pretty much describes who I am, or at least, with my upbringing.
Okay. Now, what education, because you've come a long way from a trailer in Bath County,
yeah.
What education and work background do you have, and how has it helped you serve as a member of the state senate?
You know, I believe that each one of us is a sum of our experiences, and I certainly bring all of those to bear as a legislator. I've been in the legislature now in the House and the Senate for a total of 28 years. I was in Bath County Public Schools. I went all the way through the public school system in Bath County. I went to a little teacher's college in southern West Virginia. Concord College. I went to Wake Forest Law School, the best law school I could get into. I practiced law for 35 years, basically out in the country. I was a prosecutor for 4 years. I was the elected Commonwealth Attorney in Bath County for 4 years before I went to the legislature. I've done a lot of different sorts of law practice as a country lawyer for all that time. I also had a hand in raising four kids. So all of that, I think, comes to bear as your experiences, and they've helped me be a better legislator.
Now, Cree, you are seeking re-election as senator from the 25th District. What areas does the 25th District cover?
Well, the 25th District is a diverse district, and it's spread all over the country. It looks like somewhat like a U. It covers most of Albemarle, Charlottesville, Nelson County, Rockbridge County, the cities of Lexington and Buena Vista, Allegheny County, the city of Covington, Bath County, and Highland County.
Highland County's gorgeous. So is Bath.
Well, Bath County is, I think, the prettiest place in the world. But Highland County is just a very special place. You know, it's the least populous county east of the Mississippi, the highest average altitude for a county east of the Rocky Mountains. It is just a gorgeous place.
It's like the Alps almost. I've driven through there. It's absolutely gorgeous.
They call it Virginia's Little Switzerland.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC's 25th District Senate Candidate Forum. I'm Jeff Leonard. With us in studio today is Cree Deeds. Cree, how have you been active in recent years to help improve life in Central Virginia beyond your efforts as senator?
Well, I've worked, in my community. I'm active in my Brewerton Club. I'm active in a lot of social organizations, a lot of cultural, and my church. You know, though, honestly, I'm on the road so much between practicing law, being a senator, and campaigning for office that I don't get to my church as often as I'd like. I'm not as active in my Brewerton Club now as often as I support a number of organizations, food banks, both here in Charlottesville and in the Shenandoah Valley, and also one in Richmond. I support a nature camp, a organization that's somewhat of an academic camp in Rockbridge County that provides services to a whole lot of young people, and a lot of young people in the Charlottesville area participated in that over through the years, and I've tried the best I can to be active beyond being a senator, a lawyer, a husband, and somebody who has horses and chickens to take care of, but honestly I don't have a lot of time for that.
Right. So I don't think it's any secret that you've been through a lot over the past couple of decades. And, you've run for two statewide offices. And, at some point, a decision has to be made. Why did you decide now? I mean, it takes a lot of time and a lot of energy to serve as senator and to do what you do. What factored in into your decision to run again?
You know, I still get goosebumps about the job, to think that I get to do this. That, you know, the way I look at it, you only live so many years, and you've got to use the years you have to do more than just accumulate things and accumulate money. You have to try to make a difference, and you have to try to improve things for people other than yourself. And I've worked very hard to try to live that ethic the last 28 years as a legislator, and I still have things to do. I'm in the middle of work that's very important to me, and I think very, very substantive work that makes a difference in the life of the Commonwealth, and I want to continue that work. I enjoy the work, the public service work in the Senate. I think I'm good at it. I want to continue it. I acknowledge that it's not... you know, it takes a lot of time, and sometimes I might complain about the workload, but nobody makes me do this. It's volunteer, and it's an incredible honor to be able to do it.
And on the horizon is a possible Democratic takeover of both the House and the Senate, so things could become a little easier for you, or at least more fun.
Well, frankly, it'll be more work. You know, if we get the majority, and I think we will, and I'm returned, I will chair a substantive committee. I will go on the Finance Committee. My committee assignments will change significantly, and that will just mean that'll mean more to do, more work, and I'm looking forward to it. Frankly, I'm anxious about it because I think I can make more of a difference. I think I've proven that I can be effective within a Republican-controlled legislature. I can be even more effective in a Democratic-controlled legislature.
Excellent.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC's 25th District State Senate Candidate Forum. I'm Bob McAdams, and with us in the studio today is Cree Deeds. Cree, in the lead up to August 11th and August 12th of 2017, especially during the month after the July 8th KKK rally, Charlottesville City Council struggled to deal with the permit request for the Unite the Right rally. They had a dilemma of having to choose between free speech and public safety. What should the state government do to support any municipality in Virginia facing a similar, potentially violent event?
You know, no right is absolute, and that includes the right of free speech. That includes the right of assembly. You've got an obligation to make sure that the public is as safe as possible. The state needs to not only have the resources available in terms of law enforcement to make sure that the safety can be promoted during the event, but the law ought to be changed to allow localities to permit or to prohibit the possession of firearms in certain assembled caucuses like that or assemblies, so you can do a better job of assuring public safety. We need to. You know, there was a great book written about 29 years ago called "Reinventing Government." We ought to always be about the process of making sure we can efficiently and effectively do the things that people expect of government. Make sure we can provide the services, and certainly we ought to be able to provide free assemblies so people can express their opinions, but the public absolutely has to be assured that that's going to be done so in a non-threatening, safe environment. And there were problems with that event. I was here on August 12th, 2017. I'd gone by the time the violence occurred, but there are things that state government definitely can do to ensure things like that don't occur in the future.
Now, the events in Charlottesville on August 11th and 12th, they showed the overt racism of white supremacists. Now, mass shootings in Texas, California, and Pennsylvania confirmed the Southern Poverty Law Center reports of a rapid increase in the number of hate groups over the past 2 years. How should the General Assembly respond to the overt racism of white supremacy?
You know, I'd really hoped that we had... You know, we'd grown as a society, that we were, you know, I was among those that naive enough to believe that we were moving into a post-racial sort of society, and that obviously has not occurred. Racism is still rampant, and we have to acknowledge that. We have to talk openly about the past. We have to acknowledge the past mistakes we as a society have made, and until we openly and honestly can grasp the full magnitude of our past sins, including slavery, on people of color in this country. Until we can do that and have open and honest discussions, I'm afraid we're still going to be pushing our problems down the road, and we're going to be sweeping the problems under a rug that's going to continue to bite us. We have to, I think, openly and honestly discuss our failures as a people, and only then can we promote the sort of dialogue that I think is going to produce the harmony that we all want. I'm a guy that believes always I want to see the glass half full, and I want to believe that we're going to be able to have those open, honest dialogues. I want to believe that we're going to be able to continue to use the events of August 11th and 12th, 2017, to promote more greater understanding among all people in Charlottesville and the Commonwealth and, frankly, in the country.
You know, I get the sense in the General Assembly there's sort of two sides. The one side that says we don't have a problem, and the other side that says there's a huge problem, and that's not even a place to even begin the dialogue about what needs to be done.
Well, there are a lot of things we don't have mature discussion about. It's very easy. You know, in the House of Delegates, you have to remember, you're never more than a year away from an election or a campaign. So the people that are in the House of Delegates are in permanent campaign mode, and they respond to the people that turn out and vote in their elections. And to a large degree, that has been where the discussion point has been. In the Senate, we've been able to have more discussion, I think, but frankly, a Democratic takeover of that body will enable us to have more of a frank discussion, I think, and be able to get some things done.
You know, prejudice comes in many forms. Women still earn less than men for doing the same work. Members of the LGBTQ community can be fired without cause simply for being who they are. I think that just got in the Supreme Court the other day. What could our state government do to overcome these injustices?
Well, two very important questions. The first revolves around the Equal Rights Amendment. A lot of people say, well, why is the Equal Rights Amendment still relevant? And aren't we past time for ratifying that? Well, I'd say it is still relevant. Women still make less than 70% of men doing the same job. The Equal Rights Amendment would give women, if it were the law, would give women the legal basis to go to court and establish equal pay. If we can't, if it doesn't establish it already, it'll give them a legal right to do that. And we are I would argue that it is still relevant. Congress put a moratorium, I guess, or a time limit on its passage when Congress enacted it years ago. But the question is, does Congress have the authority? Did they have the authority to impose that time limit? You know, just a few years ago, we finally ratified a constitutional amendment that was proposed as part of the Bill of Rights, the constitutional amendment that prohibits Congress from passing a pay increase for Congress until that takes effect until an election occurs. So that was more than 200 years in the making. This is certainly still relevant and still something we can do. We are maybe one or two votes in the House of Delegates from getting that, becoming the 38th state in the country to ratify the ERA. And once we do that, it will become the law of the land and will assure women equal pay for equal work. And I'm anxious to get that done. I'm confident we'll do it. Now, with respect to LGBT rights, we've had bills last few years to protect people from discrimination in housing and in employment, and we've not been able to get those bills advanced, at least through the House of Delegates. In the Senate, we always have close votes, and sometimes we can pass things, sometimes we can't. But I'm confident we can do that if we elect the Democratic majorities. And if we elect Democratic majorities in both the House and the Senate, I'm confident we can make that the law.
Yeah, I worked for the state government for a long time, and depending on who the governor was, we would get these executive orders either having the LGBTQ community as a protected class that we couldn't fire, or removing them from a protected class that we could fire. So every time the new governor would come in, I would jokingly ask my boss, can we fire these people now? And so they'd be like, shut up and go back and do your work.
Well, and the sad thing is, you know, it's real people. Real people's
absolutely
lives.
Absolutely it is.
And careers at stake. And so it's important that we change the law to protect all people equally. That's what equal protection under the law means.
I agree, and that's why I bring that up, is that people don't understand sort of the real implications. I mean, you think, oh, who cares if they're, you know, what's the difference? The difference is they can get fired for doing nothing other than being who they are.
Virginia is basically an employment at will state. You know, any one of us can be hired or fired for any reason at any time, except unless it has to do with sex, age, or race. We've got to protect all our citizens.
I would agree.
And that's why we have to pass these laws.
So gun violence, to take a turn, takes the lives of Virginians every day. After the mass shooting in Virginia Beach, Governor Northam called for a special session of the General Assembly, which you were probably there, to address specific gun legislation. On July 9th, the General Assembly abruptly adjourned that session without doing anything. How do you assess the problem of gun violence, and what laws do you believe the General Assembly should act in response? And what was it like being there when you thought you were going to do something and then you all had to go home?
Well, it's very frustrating to be in the minority because you really don't control the agenda. You don't control how long you're going to be in session, what bills get heard. I was, you know, not only in the minority on the floor, I was in the minority on the Courts of Justice Committee that was supposed to hear those bills, and the bills rapidly got referred to the Crime Commission, where there have been hearings, but I don't expect much to happen there until we have a change in the legislature. We don't have mature discussions about things like guns. We all choose up sides. We go to our corners. We shout at each other, and rapidly the decisions, which have already been made, are clear. If you take a poll of Virginians on gun violence issues, you'll find that over 90% of Virginians, and I'm talking Virginians in blue districts and red districts, favor universal background checks. You know, we already have decided that certain classes of people can't have firearms. People that have committed felonies, people that have committed domestic violence, people that have been subject to temporary detention orders and been admitted to hospitals for mentally those who have mental illness. What a universal background check would ensure that those folks can't get guns. That's one bill that will pass quickly, I think, if we have Democratic majorities. We also have red flag laws, which some people confuse with laws aimed at people that have mental illness, but they're really laws aimed at people that a family member or a law enforcement officer can go to a magistrate and say, this person is getting ready to blow up. This person has access to firearms. Arms and they are they're going to explode soon if we don't intervene. If a magistrate finds there's probable cause, and that can be appealed to the district court, so that the person's due process rights are protected. You can temporarily remove firearms from a situation. There are 17 or 18 states that have enacted those laws. What they've shown, they've only been enforced 2 years, so the data is pretty raw, but they've shown a couple of important things. Number one, the number of deaths by the suicides by firearm go down, have been reduced pretty dramatically. And number two, domestic disturbances between people that are involved with each other are less. Those encounters are less lethal. They're less lethal because the firearms have been removed. They've been successful. They've passed in Democratic states. They passed in Republican states. That's a bill that certainly makes a lot of sense for Virginia. There are other things like limiting the size of magazines for firearms. That ought to, we ought to be able to openly debate that and consider that. I think that would pass as well. There could be other bills.
Well, thanks, Trey. It was a great discussion. We got to take a short break. And we're back. I'm Jeff Leonard, and I'm co-hosting my friend Bob McAdams, a 94.7 WPVC election special interview with 25th District State Senate candidate and current seat holder, Cree Deeds. Bob and Cree, we're talking about the issues.
And the issues don't get any easier. Cree, having health care available in a time of need is a necessity for all people in our area. Lowering the high cost of health insurance is another need for many people in the 25th District. What efforts by state government to address these real concerns do you support? What further actions are needed?
Access to health care is a key to success in life. A healthy workforce is a productive workforce. One of the reasons I'm really proud of Medicaid expansion, which already has benefited more than 321,000 Virginians, more than 8,000 of whom live in the 25th Senatorial District, is that we have been able to speak truth to the notion that all people are entitled to health care, that it's a right. It is a right. We saw here in Charlottesville in 2017 a real failure of the system when we had only one insurance company providing services here. It gave us an opportunity to try to find out what works and what doesn't in terms of the state regulatory scheme. And frankly, the Bureau of Insurance, in my view, failed. It failed to protect consumers in the Charlottesville area. And we, what we've tried to do since then, we passed legislation to make this, the process of setting rates more transparent. We pushed the Bureau of Insurance and the State Corporation Commission to try to do more digging to find out exactly why this Optima rate increase occurred. We know now that Optima is going to have to return a significant amount of money to ratepayers in Virginia because of their 2017 spike in rates. But we know that under the law, as they interpret it, and apparently as the Board of Insurance interprets it, or the Bureau of Insurance, the rebates are going to go to people all over Virginia, not just to the Charlottesville market. So the people that paid the highest rates in the country aren't going to see the return they ought to see. And I'm mad as heck about that, and I'm trying to figure that out. But there are other issues that we're going to have to keep working on. You know, we've considered legislation in the past to make sure that the children we have that have fallen through the cracks from our CHIPS program and through from Medicaid are covered. There are other people that have spoken to me very recently about finding ways to provide universal coverage in Virginia. In the past, that's been really tough because, you know, my view is that that's something that ought to come from the federal level. But frankly, you know, we can't sit around and wait on the federal government to act forever. Sometimes it seems like nothing ever happens up there. That's the pace of change is frustratingly slow at the federal level, and we're probably going to have to continue to work, look for ways to ensure more people at a lower cost in Virginia. Because I'm confident we on track to make sure that everybody gets coverage.
Now, access to health care is a challenge for many Virginians, but getting care for mental illness or substance abuse is even more of a challenge.
Right.
There are limits to insurance coverage and the lack of professionals in the field mean that many people with mental health problems go untreated. You are very familiar with these issues, but what should the state do to help people with mental illness and substance abuse get care, particularly in light of the opioid epidemic?
Oh, well, wow, that's such a deep subject and something I've spent so much time talking about and thinking about over the last 5+ years, almost 6 years. You know, Bob, the reality is we're almost an entire, the Commonwealth of Virginia, even Northern Virginia, we are a medically underserved area when it comes to behavioral health care. We have shortages across the board in psychiatrists. The bucket is almost empty of pediatric psychiatrists. We have we've got shortages of psychologists. We've got shortages of licensed clinical social workers, of counselors across the board. Workforce issues are very real there. But we have to begin this discussion by acknowledging that the brain is part of the body, that mental health concerns equate to physical health concerns. They're more complicated, and so they require a little additional thought and a little additional work. But we have to acknowledge that the dignity of people who struggle with mental illness. We also have to acknowledge that substance abuse disorders are effectively a disease, that people who are addicted are subject to behavioral health disease, just like, you know, and similar to a mental illness. It is a mental illness. And frankly, we have to be able to provide those people care. We've got huge needs across the board. Number one, with substance abuse, but also with people that struggle with mental illness, we've got to do a better job of diverting those people from the criminal justice system. You know, we started the process in 1963 of deinstitutionalizing the mentally ill. The sad truth is we've reinstitutionalized too many of them in jails and prisons. We've got to figure out how to divert more of those people from the criminal justice system. And there are plenty of examples. Miami-Dade, Florida, San Antonio and Texas are good examples of places where they've had a lot of success diverting people from the criminal justice system. We have to do a better job of investing in community services, because that's where we can more effectively and more efficiently provide services to the people that need it. We've got to figure the right form of system, you know, and by that I mean we've got to integrate our community service boards, 40 of them, with our state hospitals, 10, to be able to more efficiently spend money and provide the services. The reality is we have more hospital beds per capita than most states. We spend more money more per capita than most states on hospital care. That means we have less money to spend on our community services. That community services boards provide service to 98% of the people that the state provides mental health services to. So we spend about 51-52% of our dollar providing services to 2% in our state hospitals, and that's not a very efficient way or an effective way to care for people. We've got a lot of work to do, in other words.
Yeah, just to reiterate, I mean, I was talking to Martin Coomer, who is our head of our local jail. He says 50% of the people there suffer from some form of mental illness, and over 80% have substance abuse problems. So I think you're on to something. Statistics reveal another issue with our criminal justice system. It's that of systemic racism. It's from police stops to prosecutions to incarcerations. Whites have a clear advantage over people of color. What should or can the General Assembly do to make sure all Virginians can trust that justice is equally administered by police officers, prosecuting attorneys, judges, probation officers, and prison staff? And I realize that's not an easy question.
It's not an easy question, but it's a necessary question. You know, in 2018, Delegate Marcia Price from Newport News had a bill that would have required police officers to go through an implicit bias sort of training to help people, you know, understand, and it's what I was talking about earlier. We have to be able to talk about the problems we've had, and we have to be able to have mature discussions about them, and then we have to move on. She had an implicit bias training mandate bill in 2018 that we need to take another look at, and I think we will with a Democratic majority. You know, we've proven, you know, with crisis intervention training, for example, that is a 40-hour course that builds in some de-escalation skills and helps police officers across the board. And we've got examples of it right here in Charlottesville and Albemarle County, but the best example, in my view, is out in San Antonio, Texas, where crisis intervention training gives people de-escalation skills. It's somewhat counterintuitive to what you think of a police officer. You think they're going to be rough and tumble and be prepared to deal with the situation. They're going to have the escalation skills built in to meet any offender and take them down. But the CIT training, like an implicit bias, gives additional tools to understand the situation they're encountering and hopefully have a better result, and oftentimes divert people from the criminal justice system. So I think, you know, crisis intervention training primarily has helped deal with diverting people that struggle with mental illness from the criminal justice system. Implicit bias training would give police officers tools to understand a little bit better about the bias that's sometimes built into the situation when it comes to race.
You know, I've taken the CIT training, and it was fun to see some of the more resistant police officers come in day one on Monday. And, you know, you have to go through experiential learning, or what they call role playing, which no one's excited about. But by the end of the week, they really started to get it, and change can occur. So I think you're right.
Let me tell you, you know, San Antonio, Texas, 1.7 million people. They have 2,300 police officers. All 2,300 of them have CIT training. Go on YouTube. There's a look up San Antonio CIT. There's one where a couple of police officers are talking about how reluctant they were to go through this CIT training in the first place. They didn't think it was going to do any good. They didn't think it was going to be part of what was going to be part of the job they were going to be required to do as police officers, but how it changed the way they do the job. And in that community, they talk about $10 million in savings annually in the cost of correction by diverting people from jail, diverting people from the criminal justice system. You know, and it's all built on CIT training and a mental health docket, a mental health court. We've got a docket here in Charlottesville, Albemarle County, and I applaud the people that have put that together over the years. We need more of those throughout the Commonwealth of Virginia.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC's 25th District State Senate candidate forum. I'm Bob McAdams. Cree, the release of the 2019 SOL scores show that the achievement gap based on race, ethnicity, and economic disadvantage remains throughout the state, despite efforts by several school divisions to close the gap. What role does the state government have in this problem, and what should the General Assembly do to address it?
Sure. Well, first off, the SOLs have to, you know, what I worried about in 1994 when they were part of the discussion when they were proposed. I was among a minority of legislators that argued that the SOLs would force us to de-emphasize vocational education and would also impose cost on localities. I was right, but I lost that discussion. In 2014, I guess, I carried a bill to basically reduce the number of tests required under the SOLs and to create the SOL commission that has resulted in even more reduction, more reductions, not in the standards, but in the testing and modification of standards. So the SOLs, I hope, are going through the process of evolution to become more realistic. What we need to do is think real hard about our education system and think about hard about our commitment to K-12 education. Frankly, that is the most important lever we have to make sure that everybody has an opportunity to succeed in this country and this Commonwealth. We need to rethink the way the value we place on public education. We need to rethink the value we put on the teacher. You know, we are the 10th or 11th wealthiest state in the country, and our teachers are 30. We basically have a feeder teacher system that goes from the low wage jurisdictions like the county I live in, Bath, and other rural localities, and works its way up through the Albemarle, Charlottesville, Henrico, to Prince William and Loudoun and Fairfax and Arlington County, and you go across the river to Montgomery County, Maryland, and they're making $10,000 a year more than our teachers in Fairfax and Arlington are. So my view is part of educational reform is making sure we revalue the teacher, revalue our education. What we need to do specifically with respect to the attainment gap that appears to exist and does exist in some school districts is we need to, when we're revaluing education in our society, we need to rethink the school year. We're not an agrarian nation anymore. We're not an agrarian state. You know, I live in Bath County, very rural county, but I can count on one hand the number of traditional full-time farmers that are still working in Bath County. We don't need a long summer vacation anymore. We ought to have year-round school, in my view. We ought to increase the instructional year, increasing the number of days, instructional days that are there. And if we can refocus on the teacher, if we can refocus on the school year itself, and if we can add instructional days, I think we can reduce this attainment gap. We can reduce the learning gap that occurs over the summer everywhere, and occurs in certain populations more. And we can focus more on the child and focus more on raising the level across the board.
Now, the recently released housing needs assessment for Planning District 10 that covers a lot of central Virginia shows that many people in the area struggle to afford a place to live. Many groups in our area are calling for more affordable housing, which brings up related concerns about racial disparities in home ownership and substandard rural housing. What role does the state have in efforts to increase the availability of affordable housing?
You know, housing is affordable housing is a national problem. It's a state problem. And it's a local problem. It's primarily dealt with at the local level. There are things the state can do, however, and we can make sure that we tighten up the eviction laws so that you know, we focused on that the last few years to make sure that people aren't evicted unless there really are problems that cause it. There really are breaches to leases that force an eviction. We can also end the revolving door somewhat of rent to own schemes that somehow rob people of equity and property and rob people of money over the course of time. We can do a better job of providing a reliable source of funding for the housing trust fund that funds affordable housing in localities. And we ought to do a better job of working with local governments to figure out what tools they need, what additional tools they need to provide more affordable housing. You know, as I said, housing is primarily dealt with at the local level, and most localities do that through the zoning laws. I just met this past week with Charlottesville City Councilor and several folks involved in the legal backbone of the city to try to discuss housing and discuss ways that we might be able to give Charlottesville more tools. There's a particular statute that primarily affects, gives certain rights to some Northern Virginia localities to affect zoning that Charlottesville thinks will, some people in Charlottesville think, and some people in Richmond as well, think would give these two communities the ability to provide more affordable, to require more affordable housing to be built. And we're going to look at that statute and try to find ways to get it passed. And I think last year, Richmond, the city of Richmond had a bill in that didn't go anywhere. We need to, I wasn't involved in that discussion. I think it was over in the House of Delegates, but we need to sit down and figure that out. That's number one. But number two, in this community, the most important thing that can happen to promote affordable housing, to put more housing units on the market and make them more affordable, is for the University of Virginia to build more housing and require more of their students to be on campus. That's the discussion that President Ryan seems to be open to. He suggested that more housing be built. Frankly, it would take an awful lot of new housing to put much of a dent in this market. But that's a discussion that he seems to be willing to engage in.
You know, higher pay would make housing and everything else more affordable. Virginia has a minimum hourly wage of $7.25. A bill to increase the minimum wage in stages to $15 an hour failed in the Senate this year. The most recent Orange Dot report showed the great number of people in Central Virginia, including Albemarle, Charlottesville, and Nelson, who cannot afford to pay for the basic necessities. What should the state do to address the income inequalities that brings wages up to a livable level?
You know, the bill failed on a party line vote last year, and I'm confident that if we have Democratic majorities, we're going to pass a bill in the next session of the General Assembly that's modeled to a large extent off Representative Bobby Scott's bill that he introduced at the federal level to raise the minimum wage to $15 over the course of 5 or 6 years. It's not going to be instant. That's not going to be an instant $15 raise. But the significant thing about this bill would be, you know, another part that we hope to be able to add to it is that after the minimum wage is increased to $15, you would add a consumer index indexing formula to it. So every year after that, the pay or the minimum wage would increase proportionate to the consumer index. The problem with the wage, right, with the $7.25 minimum wage, is that's 10 years old. I would argue that artificially keeps wages low. You know, if you go over to Target in Waynesboro across the mountain, they're hiring people right now at $13 an hour. If you go to the Sheets in Lexington, Virginia, they're hiring people at $12 an hour, $10 an hour. You know, the $7.25 wage is too low. It affects people that are desperate and don't have any choice. We need to do a better job of requiring employers to pay a fair wage.
You know, people living in rural areas don't always have the same infrastructure available as urban dwellers, including water, roads, and communications. Lack of broadband access to the internet affects business, families, and especially students. As rural counties struggle to provide these services, how is the state helping, and what action should the General Assembly do to provide access to the internet for rural Virginians?
That's a very good question, and I would argue that there's some segments in our urban environments that are also struggling with internet. We don't have availability as readily as you would think in some of our most urban parts of the Commonwealth. You know, I would argue that broadband is very much in a position that electricity was in the 1940s. It was a necessity that people just didn't have. You know, Franklin Roosevelt signed the Rural Electrification Act in 34, 35. But rural electrification essentially electrified the rural South. In areas like the ones where I live, where the investor-owned utilities couldn't make it work to provide power. They couldn't get a profit from us because our houses were too far spread out. Rural electrification brought us into the 20th century and created a nation of consumers. It was good for everybody. The next big thing is rural broadband. And again, the rural co-ops are leading the way. BARC, a co-op that serves my area, was the first in Virginia to provide rural broadband, to go out on a limb, to borrow the money and look for grants to provide rural broadband. Central Virginia Electric, which provides provides services to part of Albemarle County and other counties. It was the second rural electric to work on broadband. I think the Southside down in Mecklenburg Burke County is the third. You know, people understand that in rural areas, you've got the ability to and the necessity to provide broadband so people can participate in the 21st century economy. Now, what we've done in Virginia so far is inadequate. The governor wanted a lot of money. They wanted more than $50 million this year to put in rural broadband. The folks in charge of the legislature trimmed that back to 19. I'm grateful for that $19 million. It's not enough. It's not enough to do one county. We have to step up and provide more money and grants and a support to be able to provide rural broadband throughout Virginia. You know, just this past week, the governor announced a $1 million ARC grant, Appalachian Regional Commission grant, to BARC to put more rural broadband in another part of the 25th district in the town of Goshen, western Rockbridge County. Last week, the governor announced that a deal had been struck with a high-tech company to promote drone-related jobs, a drone zone in the city of Covington. It's going to create 25 jobs. You know, in rural areas, we've got the ability to compete in a high-tech world, but we have to have that broadband. I think the state's going to have to step up and take more of a role.
All right. Thanks, Trey. Hate to interrupt this discussion. I've got to take another short break. Be right back. And we're back. I'm Jeff Leonard, and I'm co-hosting with my friend Bob McAdams a 94.7 WPVC election special interview with 25th District Senate candidate Cree Deeds. Bob and Cree, we got one more segment. Let's get to it.
Cree, recent reports from scientists tell us that the climate change crisis is much worse than previously understood, with years, not decades, to act. Young people who understand the urgency of this crisis are condemning the lack of action by older people who are in positions of power. This crisis overlays all the other problems we have discussed. What should the state government do to accelerate reduction of greenhouse gas emissions and hasten the transition to renewable energy sources?
Well, climate change is existential. It's the issue that touches all of us. And for me, the way it really comes home or came home was when my youngest daughter moved to Alaska, because I think in Alaska, at the glaciers, you can see most dramatically the effect of human behavior on climate change. You can measure the loss of glacial ice in the time of the Industrial Revolution, the time since we've gone wild with carbon emission, and it's very dramatic, you know. And also in Anchorage this past July, you had temperatures in the 90s. You've never had temperatures that warm before since we've been measuring temperatures in Alaska, since anybody's been measuring temperatures in Alaska. So this is an issue that. We are late to the dance, too. I still am a glass half full guy. We have to figure out how to meet this challenge as quickly as we can. The REGI compact that involves
REGI is
regional greenhouse gas initiative. That involves some of the states, primarily on the East Coast. It would allow us to. It would allow us to interact, to be involved in a trading compact with some of the other states. It's not enough. You know, we need to have more global action, but we can only do what we can do. And what we can do is figure out how to reduce emissions here. You know, as a state, we need to be leading the way. We need to lead the way. The governor's initiative to say we're not going to emit carbon, we're going to be carbon neutral by 2050 is great, but it's probably not soon enough. We need to take dramatic steps right now to make sure we're producing energy through solar and wind and renewable sources to the extent possible. As a state, we are using those resources. I think the next manufacturing economy can be built on the production of renewable energy. For example, solar panels and windmill components. But we also need to be requiring more of our state. We need to put action behind our words, and that means we need to build smarter. We need to require our state agencies to be more energy efficient, and we need to look for ways to promote renewable energy. We need to do it now.
Now, Dominion has had a lot of impact on this whole topic, and there are a lot of restrictions on solar panel deployment in terms of the total number and the percentage that's of power that's going back in the grid. And Dominion's also investing in fossil fuel technology with these pipelines coming, you know, right down through your neighborhood.
Sure.
How should the state respond to the...
Well, first, we have to acknowledge that the economy runs on energy. We have to have energy. But we also have to... find ways to produce energy. The technology is there for us to go to a renewable economy as quickly as possible. It's going to take some effort. It's going to take some commitment on our parts, but we can do that. With respect to Dominion, it's been very frustrating to me over the years that the utilities pretty much have the loudest voice at the table when it comes to regulation of energy and regulation of all utilities. We need to broaden the table. The utilities can have a place at the table, but everybody else needs a place too. We cannot allow our policy in this area to be influenced unduly by any single source, and that means that the days of Dominion dominating energy policy in Virginia are going to have to come to an end.
Now, we've talked about a lot of issues, and all candidates have these aspirations for problem solving, but they eventually meet the limits of the state budget. How do you think the General Assembly should reconcile the needs for real change with the level of revenue coming from current taxes? What new sources of revenue could the state use to meet the needs of the people?
You know, a few minutes ago, I've referenced a book that was published in about 91 called Reinventing Government. You have to constantly be about the process, not of reinventing the wheel, but of figuring out ways to do things more efficiently and effectively to make sure that government is as lean, but also as effective as it needs to be. And that means you cannot ever be closed to the notion that you're going to have to find new revenue sources. You know, there are some people who will run for office and their mantra from the get-go will be no new taxes. I don't believe in taxes. Well, taxes are the way we pay for things, the way that government operates. I don't want to raise taxes. I don't want to raise taxes, but I've been open to taxes when issues have come before me that have required that in the past. I think for now, we're taking in plenty of tax revenue. We're doling out somewhere probably around $2 billion in tax credits that need to be reexamined. I think JLARC said that. The Joint Legislative Audit and Review Commission said that several years ago, and we haven't mustered the political will, frankly, to reexamine the tax credits that we dole out. Some of those include coal production tax credits that have proven not to increase jobs. There are things we can do, I think, within existing revenue streams that will allow us to accomplish much of what we want to, and that's where I would look. I would look first before we'd ever consider raising taxes. I'd want to make sure that we're doing things as efficiently as possible with the tax dollars that we have.
All right. For local governments to meet the needs of their residents, they must have authorization from the General Assembly, either through general laws applicable to all or through special acts for individual local governments. What do you think the relationship between the General Assembly and local governments should be?
You know, and I represent, I guess, five counties, five cities, and six towns. That's six counties, five cities, and five towns. And I've worked, I think, very well with local governments at every level. But the reality is I represent the people of the 25th District. That doesn't mean I represent the city councils or the town or the boards of supervisors. I think the legislature needs to be respectful of the work that has to be accomplished at the local level and has to be in partnership with local government. But we have to always remember that we represent the people. We don't represent necessarily the local governments. The Dillon Rule is a rule that came out of an Iowa state court case in the 1870s, I think. And what that says, we're a Dillon Rule state. What that says is localities can only do what the state says they can do. You know, I've wondered about the Dillon Rule, and I've thought about it for a long, long time. You know, I think the Dillon Rule does some good things. You know, for example, when we are looking to an out-of-state company who wants to come to Virginia, that out-of-state company could look at one set of books, the Code of Virginia, and figure out what range of regulations and taxations they're going to be subject to, whether they want to be in Wise County or in Virginia Beach or in Fairfax County. They know they have one source of information, and that's been very helpful to us in terms of recruiting jobs to Virginia. Virginia. There are other ways we can modify the Dillon Rule, and I've been open to that in the past. For example, you know, given localities the ability to regulate guns in public spaces. I think there are, and I think that's the way we need to, from my perspective, that's the best way to continue to look at things. The Dillon Rule stays in place, but there are exceptions, as there always have been, and we have to be open to reexamining the needs of the localities as they arise.
Right. People also feel frustrated about the lack of action by the General Assembly. The governmental system in Virginia seems designed to prevent change. General Assembly is in session for only 60 days on even number of years and 45 on the odd. In that brief time, legislators will consider a few thousand bills, most of which are killed in subcommittee. How will you get things done in the General Assembly if reelected?
Well, you know, I think in the 28 years I've been in the legislature, I've proven I can get things done. I can get things done whether we've got a Democratic majority or Republican majority, because I view my job not necessarily as a partisan warrior, but as a person who gets elected to solve problems, as a person who gets elected to get things done for the people I represent. And that means that I will swallow my pride and work with whomever I have to, whether they're Democrat or Republican, whether they're, you know, wherever they're from, whoever it's going to take to try to accomplish what I need to accomplish. And, you know, the last few years with respect to mental health, for example, in most particular, that's what I've been focused on. And when it comes to those issues, I've not been I've not been afraid of asking for help. I've not been afraid of going to making appointments with Republican speakers of the House or Republican chairman of the appropriations committees and saying, I need your help. You've known me for a long time. You know my son. You know, I've not been afraid to call in the chits that I have to try to get things accomplished. Now, here's the thing: in a democratic republic where you've got a balance of power split among three branches and you've got a bicameral legislative process, things are going to be slow. I would argue, and progress is going to be slow, but I would argue that in Virginia we get more done certainly than the Congress does. You know, we were the first legislative body in the Western Hemisphere. Everybody else is modeled after what we did first here in Virginia, and I would argue we still do it pretty well. You know, the legislature is only in session 46 days in odd numbered years and 60 days in even numbered years. It's a part-time legislature. You know, it's a full-time responsibility but a part-time job. I think that the tension that Jefferson and the founders intended us to have was they didn't expect it to be easy to be a legislator. You know, you constantly have to, and I can attest to you that it's a constant struggle to figure out how to balance your time between being a member of the Senate, being a lawyer, taking care of your private business, your private, you know, my animals at home, and assuring my commitments to my family and then running a campaign. It's tough. But that tension, that part-time nature of our legislature keeps the members of the General Assembly closer to the people they represent and closer to the realities of the legislation they pass, I think.
You're listening to 94.7 WPVC's 25th District State Senate Forum interview with Cree Deeds. I'm Bob McAdams. Cree, you're running for state senator again from the 25th District. This district extends over a wide area from Charlottesville and Albemarle south to Boiling Springs and west of the West Virginia border. How will you engage voters over this wide area leading up to the November 5th election, and how can voter participation be increased in all elections?
You know, I've really been discouraged over the years by the low turnout in some of these elections. I've pushed back against some of the legislation over the years that have tried to crimp even further the ability of people to participate in the process. In my view, you know, I want to see 100% of the people registered to vote. I want to see 100% turnout. As a person who campaigns over this wide area, the best you can do is talk to people where they are, be in the communities where they live, be in every community that you represent. Over the years, I've maintained an 800 telephone number because I recognize that the district is spread out. I can't be everywhere all the time. I've maintained an office in Charlottesville. I maintain an office in Hot Springs. That's where I practice law. I'm in courts all over the place. I've been willing and eager to go to communities to participate in different events, and I'll continue to do that. I've been doing it for 28 years. I will continue to do things exactly the way I've done them in the past. I view public service as a real honor and an opportunity of a lifetime, honestly, to be able to participate in this. Sure, I've had some disappointments. I've had some races I didn't win, but that's the way the world works. You have to get up and keep moving. And I try to make a difference in the lives of the people I represent, and I work hard at it every day, and I'm going to keep doing that.
Now, every campaign needs to pay for the basics to get the candidate's message to as many people as possible. At the same time, corporate money and corporate lobbying are seen as preventing government from taking action on real issues facing the people. How will you raise the funds to pay for those basics for your campaign? And what do you think should be done about the influence of money in state politics?
You know, and let me address lobbying first. In a perfect world, you know, we talked earlier about, you know, several thousand bills in a 60-day session. That's a lot of work, and a legislator operates on the best information available. In a perfect world, you have lobbyists on both sides of the issue, and the lobbyists you use as an educational tool. You know, you have arguments from competing sides, and you can weigh them to figure out what the right thing to do is on the bill. But we don't live in a perfect world, and you don't have lobbyists every time, and sometimes you just have lobbyists on one side. You know, as a legislator, I think you have to understand the role of a lobbyist is to advocate for their side, and you have to take that with a grain of salt and try to figure out what the right thing is. And if there's not anybody on the other side, you have to do the research and try to figure things out the best you can. Money is honestly always been an issue, and I've worried about the influence of money on politics in the late 90s, and also since then I've co-sponsored and voted for legislation to put federal style type limits on contributions. Those bills haven't passed. I've voted for legislation to prevent regulated monopolies from contributing. Those bills haven't passed. So I will continue to raise money and continue to work the way I've always done. And I'll just ask my friends, and I'll ask. I'm not independently wealthy. I've not had the luxury of turning down too many contributions over the years. And I will continue to raise money the best way that I can, and work at it the way that any guy that running for office does. You know, I'm proud that despite the fact that I've raised a significant amount of money over the last years, that I've been noted. I've been validated by third parties as an independent voice on some issues. You know, for example, on Bacon's Rebellion, which is a conservative leaning blog, that was this past spring, they noted that on Dominion issues, on utility issues, there were only two consistently pro consumer members of the state Senate, and I was one of them. The guy that wrote that column was a guy named Steve Hainer, who used to lobby for Norfolk's for the Newport News Shipyard, and also was the executive director of the Republican House Caucus back in the late 80s. So not necessarily somebody who was going to write good things about a Democratic member of the state Senate. If you can't take somebody's money and then vote against them, you shouldn't have any business being in the legislature.
So what's the best way for people to get in touch with you, your campaign, to learn more about you and to volunteer and possibly donate?
SenatorDeeds.com is my webpage. My phone number in Charlottesville is 296-5491. My phone number in Hot Springs is 540-839-2473. I'm accessible all the time. I'm out and about. I'm in Charlottesville, frankly, 5 or 6 days a week this time of year. And that will continue through November 5. But most importantly, I want to remind people that the last day to register to vote is this coming Tuesday, the 15th. And you're not going to be able to participate if you don't register. And make sure your registration is in the right place. If you've got any doubts about that, call your registrar's office or go by. And you can do a lot of that work online, but it needs to be done by Tuesday.
All right. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Cree, thanks so much for spending this hour with our WPVC listeners.
Thank you.
This is one of our series of election special interviews with candidates in our area seeking a nomination for city councilor, county supervisor, delegate, and state senator in the November 5th election. Each interview is available for podcast on our website, 947wpvc.org. We thank Cree Deeds for giving us his time so that you, our listeners, can make the best choice for candidates in the next state senate election. Next week, Elliot Harding, who is seeking election as a state senator to represent the 25th district, will be in our studio for our election special interview. Thanks for listening. 947 WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.
You've been listening to the 94.7 WPVC Election Special Candidates Forum. Join us again next Sunday morning at 10 as we talk to yet another candidate for local office in Virginia's 2019 off-year elections. You can hear this program again or suggest questions for upcoming guests at 947WPVC.org or link to it through our Facebook page. Thanks for listening.